Boris Johnson repeatedly told Britons would be a moment of truth.
It's really quite damning because it demonstrates this culture of booziness right at the heart of government, particularly at a time when the rest of the country was in extremis, being locked down. People were dying and not being able to see their relations.
Only a day earlier, revelations the Prime Minister met with Sue Gray at the beginning of the month, allegedly to try and change her mind about publishing her report. And before that, a police investigation that handed him, Chancellor Rishi Sunak, and several others a penalty. The report that blames top officials for breaking lockdown rules also comes in the wake of new photos of the PM toasting his departing head of communications during the second national lockdown, pictures that to many crossed the line. Soon after the report was published, a seemingly repentant Boris Johnson, who had initially told Parliament no rules had been broken, faced the wrath of the MPs.
Well, people stayed at home to protect the NHS. The Prime Minister was engaging in drinking and debauchery that makes a mockery of the gut-wrenching sacrifices that each and every person made. Will the Prime Minister now take the opportunity and resign?
As much as the Prime Minister hopes the country would move on from Partygate, experts say Gray's conclusions could revive calls from Conservative MPs for a no-confidence vote in him. If he lost such a vote, he would lose his job.
Many of his own backbenchers, including Mark Harper, have come out to say that he is not leading as one should lead. He is not setting the kind of example, indeed, the country needs. If the country is in a time of war, this is not the kind of example that will inspire people to follow him as a leader.
Boris Johnson has clung onto power partly because of the Russian military intervention in Ukraine that diverted political and public attention here. And he plans on keeping it that way by expediting a relief package to help vulnerable Britons through the cost of living crisis. Now, whether or not that will help him survive politically is a matter of wait and see. Saeed Pariza, London.
Russian forces and their allies have gained full control of the town of Lyman in the Donetsk region. That's according to the Russian Defense Ministry. The railway hub lies on the road to the key cities of Slovyansk and Kramatorsk, which are still under Kiev's control. It is also located 40 kilometers west of the largest Donbass city of Severodonetsk, the current focus of the Russian offensive in the east. Luhansk's governor says Russian troops have entered Severodonetsk. Elsewhere in the south, local authorities say the southwestern Ukrainian port city of Mykolaiv came under Russian shelling on Saturday. The city is 60 kilometers from the Russian-held city of Kherson. Also, according to a regional military governor, Russian forces have pounded the district of the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv.
The road to Svetlodarsk, a town in Donbass recently taken by the Russian army and separatist militias. The town is home to around 10,000 people, most of whom stayed during the fighting. I'm surprised to see little damage here.
Nothing happened, fortunately, in the town itself. But the joint forces of the DPR, LPR, and Russia broke the so-called Svetlodarsk Arc, and the enemy lost all interest in fighting and left, so the battle is now behind the town. Kiev do not give their army enough motivation. We're on our land, and we're defending it. And at the moment, we're going forward. They are on foreign land.
Up on this plinth, in this square here, there would have been a Russian statue. My translator think it may have been a statue of Lenin, but the Ukrainians have been pulling down these statues, trying to erase any Russian culture or signs of Russian culture in areas they take. But now this is back under Russian control, this town.
These last 8 years, we've been living under humiliation. And when the Russian soldiers came, we've been waiting for them. But we are also Russians. We understand Russians. We think and live like Russians do. That's why we were waiting for them.
First of all, I think it will be easier to breathe. We do not understand yet. Our fear is that the Russian military will move on and leave the town without defense, and that we will be under shelling again.
I am taken to a townhouse which served as a Ukrainian military base. the remnants of what the soldiers left as they fled. They tried to hide tanks here, but the building was still struck by a Russian airstrike. Now, these are pictures drawn by children, quite possibly sent to the Ukrainian soldiers. These ones here say, "We want peace." This one here says, "Please return alive." As the Russian army continues their advance in Donbass, more towns like this in the coming days and weeks will raise the Russian flag. Meanwhile, civilians throughout the Donbass, whether pro-Russian or pro-Ukrainian, will be hoping that this war will soon come to an end.
What they lack in number, they make up for in solidarity. Supporters of a British pro-Palestine priest facing a week-long Church of England tribunal here for his views on Israel. 68-year-old Reverend Stephen Sizer, a retired Anglican vicar known for his opposition to Christian Zionism, a belief among some Christians that the establishment of Israel in 1948 was in accordance with biblical prophecy, accused of anti-Semitism.
We're concerned about how people who are speaking up against the crimes against humanity that are being committed by apartheid Israel are being targeted. And people and organizations in this country that are apologists for apartheid, that are actually supportive of the apartheid state of Israel, are actually using regulatory processes to actually target individuals and stop any kind of dissent from being said.
One such group, the pro-Israel Board of Deputies of British Jews, that's accused Dr. Sizer of making public statements that conflicts with the so-called International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism adopted by the Church of England. The definition conflates harsh criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism.
There's no exemption from their attempt to shut down pro-Palestinian discourse. And the reason is very simple. They've lost the debate. If they were winning the debate, they wouldn't be trying to shut down Stephen Sizer, but they know that public opinion, because of what Israel does and because of the Palestinian resistance, they know that they're very, very unpopular in public opinion.
And it's not the first time this is happening. Dr. Sizer faced similar accusations in 2013, but was exonerated in return for not posting about Palestine on social media. Nearly 10 years later, he's once again the subject of a pro-Israel witch hunt.
I think it's because Reverend Dr. Stephen Sizer was not obedient, and he continued to advocate for Palestine and against the crimes of the State of Israel, and they decided to bring him to heel in an exemplary way. You know, they've pretty much cleaned out the Labour Party. They've got scalps there. They've attacked people in academia. They got people fired in Bristol. They've even tried to take on musicians like Lowkey.
A final verdict is expected in the coming weeks, but what this case and similar ones show, these activists say, is the length to which the British state will go in silencing all criticism of Israel and its apartheid against Palestinians. Saeed Bouriza, London.
On Friday, two-time Prime Minister of Italy and former President of the European Union, Romano Prodi, had his say on the Ukraine crisis and subsequent geopolitical developments during a meeting with journalists held at the International Press Association headquarters in Rome, known for having overseen an extensive privatization of Italy's public assets and for his lack of ostentation. Prodi is today a retired politician. He expressed serious concerns at how the sanctions imposed against Russia over the conflict in Ukraine will reverberate through the European Union, with the risk of creating divisions among the members of the bloc.
The Ukraine crisis fallout will hit the EU badly. Sanctions would cost a lot to Italy and Germany, less to other EU countries. Brussels has reacted unitedly to Russia, but peace must remain paramount.
Italy and Germany are the countries which have relied on Russian energy the most over the past 20 years. Rome has been trying to diversify its energy sources, but it will take at least 2-3 years before it achieves a total replacement of Russian gas. Since the start of the war in Ukraine, Rome has been trying to wean itself off Russian gas, which currently accounts for over 40% of total gas imports. However, according to the National Bureau of Statistics, is that Italy's imports from Russia rose around 120% in value in April, while Italian exports to Russia showed an annual fall of almost 50% in the same period.
I have said many times that the impact of the sanctions against Russia will be completely asymmetrical. It goes without saying that the consequences on some countries like France or Spain will be milder.
Earlier this week, Moscow dismissed the plan for peace in Ukraine proposed by Italy. Also, Hungary has urged Brussels to call explicitly for a ceasefire in Ukraine. However, so far, some members of the bloc and the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen have adopted a hawkish posture on Russia, never making any mention of peace talks. Max Civili, Rome.
The UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Afghanistan has concluded his 11-day trip to the country. Holding a press conference in Kabul, Richard Bennett expressed concern about the violation of human rights in Afghanistan, calling on the Taliban to abide by their promises.
Afghanistan is facing a plethora of critical human rights challenges that are having a severe impact on the population. I urge the authorities to acknowledge the human rights challenges that they are facing and to close the gap between their words and their deeds.
Mr. Bennett also called for investigation into blind terror attacks in the country, saying systematic attacks on Shia Hazaras involve marks of crimes against humanity.
I call for investigations into a series of attacks on places of worship and schools in Kabul, Kunduz, and Balkh provinces, instances of which have been claimed by the ISISK group. In particular, such attacks specifically targeting members of the Hazara, Shia, and Sufi communities are becoming increasingly systematic in nature and reflect elements of an organizational policy, thus bearing the hallmarks of crimes against humanity.
The UN expert also urged the international community to continue relief funds to Afghanistan, saying sanctions on the Taliban should not harm the Afghan people.
The humanitarian and economic crisis is very concerning, and I call on the international community to continue to provide humanitarian support and to ensure that the implementation of applicable sanctions do not substantially impede the provision of essential public services accessible to all, which are necessary for the enjoyment of human rights.
The independent expert advised the Taliban to form an inclusive government and establish fair engagement with the people if they want to end instability and suffering on Afghan soil. The UN expert's trip to Afghanistan comes as the country has been facing rights violations in different aspects. Afghan people hope their rights are protected and the international community closely watches developments in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol promised to move the country closer to the United States, expanding trade and strengthening the military alliance. When Yoon recently hosted a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden, he went so far as to place his hand over his heart during the American national anthem, drawing condemnation from many South Koreans, including activists critical of U.S.-South Korea ties.
I believe it destroyed Koreans' pride. How can the president of one country do such a thing? I think Yoon Suk-yeol is a pro-American toady, and this act showed his unfiltered political inclinations.
Koo San-ha and her group demonstrated against the U.S.-South Korea alliance during Biden's visit.
The essence of the South Korea-U.S. alliance is to subordinate South Korea and give up South Korean interests to protect American hegemony and American interest.
In contrast, outside the U.S. embassy, one-man demonstrator Han Ga-ki says he has received a lot of support over his two-year-long vigil in favor of strong U.S.-South Korea ties.
South Korea, the United States, and Japan have come together to protect and defend liberal democracy. So the South Korea-U.S. alliance is essential. It's a matter of freedom being taken away or keeping your freedom.
South Korea is anything but a free rider when it comes to its alliance relationship with the United States. Seoul pays about $1 billion per year toward the cost of hosting 28,500 U.S. troops here. South Korea also spends billions of dollars on American weapons. In the wake of North Korea's recent missile tests, Yoon wants to see American strategic assets, nuclear-capable bombers and ships, conduct military drills in South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Palestinian digital rights experts have long decried the increasing censorship of Palestinian content online. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jessica Waxbaum, journalist. This article is published under the heading Censoring Palestine. Swarms of Israeli regime bots are crippling pro-Palestinian Twitter accounts. Here's more. On April 29th, Ines Abdulrazak woke up to 80 new Twitter followers. These accounts were following the exact same people that were tweeting about Palestine, but from France or Francophone accounts that work on Palestine, Razak said for her new followers. The advocacy director of Rabbit, the Palestine Institute for Public Diplomacy's digital platform, became wary of the issue after Abir Khateb, a grants manager at Open Society Foundations, reported mass followings as well. Razak told Min Press News that she began individually reporting each account as fake, but kept her own account open, lest she let the alleged bots win. But after a few days, Razak made her profile private. At the peak of the mass following, Razak had accumulated 400 fake followers. From the end of April through the first few weeks of May, more than 40 pro-Palestine Twitter accounts reported mass followings. Digital rights experts say acquiring huge amounts of fake followers triggers Twitter's algorithm and can lead to the tech giant suspending an account, effectively censoring users by forcing them to make their accounts private. These accounts included those belonging to human rights, activist organizations, Adala, Combatants for Peace, Breaking the Silence, and Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights. They also included news publications and journalists like the Palestine Chronicle, Ali Abu Nima and Hend Al-Iryani, and politicians such as Hossam Zumlot, the Palestinian ambassador to the UK. Twitter did not respond to Min Press inquiries on the source of suspicious accounts. Dr. Mark Owen Jones, an assistant professor at Hamad Ben Khalifa University, conducted an analysis that found more than 1,150 fake accounts. Twitter deleted approximately 1,090 of these accounts, according to Jones. His analysis determined that the average account creation time was one of the three per minute, suggesting these accounts were created using an automated process. The profiles were in various languages, including French, Spanish, English, and German, but usually had Arabic bias. They often had strange names like Nobel Betty Thomas and Zero Followers. They had clearly made up names, Sarah Lee Whitson, who also experienced a large influx of new followers, told Min Press. The vast majority of them had Israeli names and Israeli addresses. Some of them had made-up Arab names, which were mangled. It's clear that they are using stolen images of people. In response to the bulk following, software developer Daniel Isterman created a free script to automatically report and block hundreds of these bots for users. Isterman said the spamming problem has a censorship effect by forcing users to make their accounts private. This means they won't be able to distribute their messages widely as they would normally, Isterman told Min Press News. Another area of particular concern is how a flood of fake followers may cause Twitter to shut down an account. When you see such a dramatic increase in followers, it's usually somebody manipulating the system for commercial gain, Isterman said, adding so that could trigger Twitter to automatically flag that as suspicious activity and suspend the activist account. Using Twitter to target human rights defenders and journalists isn't unusual. In 2017, journalist Lona Craig and others who report on Yemen were spammed with thousands of fake followers. Many speculated the culprits were state entities belonging to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The reason behind this particular mass following campaign remains unknown. Jones hypothesized it's acting as a form of social media suppression, writing on Twitter. Some suggest it's a means to degrade the algorithmic quality of a Twitter account so that it possibly gets suspended. Some suggest it's others trying to boost popularity of an account. When it's unsolicited, as in this case, I tend to think it's more of a targeting operation. I'm naturally cynical, but most people who get a sudden influx of fake followers feel unnerved and uncomfortable. If that fact is widely known, it functions as a tool of surveillance and potentially intimidation, that is, you are being watched. It also makes many people mute their accounts for a bit, which has a censorship effect. Razek Whitson and others told Min Press News that the flood of fake followers appears to be diminishing for them. However, a new operation has emerged. In the past week, Jones found around 2,800 fake accounts following pro-Palestinian and anti-Zionist accounts who have recently been tweeting on the killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Akleh by the Zionist regime. This network is likely the same as one found at the end of April, although now it is active, Jones wrote on Twitter. The accounts have been 0 to 20 followers, with the majority of bias written in English and simply stating the account location, which is the occupied territories. Most accounts don't have a banner picture, and the profile pictures have reportedly been swiped from real people. According to Jones, the accounts have begun liking and retweeting posts without any real partisan regularity. They like both pro- and anti-Palestinian subject matter and follow both pro-Zionist and pro-Palestinian accounts, but appear to target the pro-Palestinian side more. Accounts targeted include the Jerusalem Post, activist organization Jewish Voice for Peace, the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement, Israeli journalist Ilan Papp, and former Palestinian Liberation Organization Executive Committee member Dr. Hanan Ashrawi. Again, the reason for the bulk followers remains unclear. Those who get followed understandably find it intimidating, as if a form of surveillance, to a technique to try and degrade the quality of an account with low-quality follows, Jones wrote on Twitter. The fact remains these are clearly fake accounts and ruin the experience of Twitter. Palestinian digital rights experts have long decried the increasing censorship of Palestinian content online. During the Zionist regime's assault on Gaza and upticks in Israeli regime attacks at Al-Aqsa compound and in Sheikh Jarrah in May 2021, Palestinian activists reported social media companies were removing their content on the Israeli regime violence and ethnic cleansing for violating community guidelines. The social media censorship didn't stop when tensions died down over the summer, though. Last month, social media users in Jordan said their posts related to Israeli regime violence at Al-Aqsa were taken down and their accounts blocked. Additionally, accounts belonging to Palestinian news publications covering the violence in East Al-Quds and at Al-Aqsa were deactivated by Facebook. In their recent monthly report on social media violations, Palestinian NGO Sada Social stated the deletion of Palestinian content is in line with and in response to Israeli requests to tighten the screws on Palestinians and their media. Razek suggested the swarm of fake followers on Twitter may be an extension of Instagram's shadow banning. While the identities behind the fake followers haven't been revealed, many have pointed to the fabricated regime of Israel. The regime of Israel targeting of Palestinian digital content is well documented. According to Hamla, the Arab Center for the Advancement of Social Media, the Israeli regime Ministry of Justice Cyber Unit sends content removal requests aimed at Palestinian content to social media companies such as Facebook, Google, and YouTube. The Justice Ministry has boasted these corporations comply with 95% of the request. And the Zionist regime organizations and NGOs also encourage their citizens to flag Palestinian content for removal. Tech billionaire Elon Musk's pending purchase of Twitter came with a promise of securing free speech on the digital platform. Free speech is the bedrock of a functioning democracy, and Twitter is the digital town square where matters vital to the future of humanity are debated, the self-declared free speech advocate said in a statement about his Twitter deal. While digital rights experts like Jones are wary of Musk's potential Twitter takeover, Whitson, who has experienced targeted attacks, harassment, and censorship threats for decades for speaking out against the Zionist regime's abuses, views this buyout positively. Whitson doesn't agree the bots are a form of censorship, but she does see them as an assault on free speech. She said it's a form of targeted harassment and bullying. It's a targeted attack on people who are speaking freely, including journalists and human rights activists.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
As the war on Ukraine continues, so does the economic damage to the world, like EU countries. While many EU countries come out and say Russia has to be sanctioned, they are not united when it comes to sanctioning Russian oil and gas. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the Ukrainian conflict, the Russian advancements militarily, the U.S.'s continuing militaristic approach, and how Kyiv is refusing to give up any territory to Russia. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. The Washington Bureau Chief at the Executive Intelligence Review, William Jones, joins us from Leesburg. Also joining us is political analyst Frank Emspach, who joins us from Madison.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. If I may first start with you, Frank Emspach, and one of the top developments coming out of the EU leaders' meeting, which occurred, is that they are not united on the issue of sanctioning Russian oil and gas. And that obviously shows the need that they have, not only for the energy that Russia offers, but at the same time that they still are keen to continue this war. And the question that comes about now is, this war has been going on for 3 months. It doesn't sound like they have found alternatives suitable enough to meet their demands. What is how do you see this situation when it comes to their efforts, saying they want to sanction Russia, but obviously failing to do so in this area?
I think there's several types of positions. There's the one about where some of the countries are dependent upon oil and gas, Germany, Hungary. There are people who have a political agenda, for instance, Turkey, who's made it very clear that they're opposed to Finland and Sweden joining NATO because of their support for the Kurds. Then there's internal political issues beyond that, where the Europeans are getting increasingly uneasy based on their statements about whose objectives we're actually fighting for here in the Ukraine. An absolutist one of the Ukrainians, there'll be not an inch of Ukrainian soil. The American ones, which is even more extreme, our goal is to weaken Russia to the point of practical collapse. Or the European one, which says we want to have some kind of settlement that'll guarantee Ukrainian sovereignty in the future, but we understand that parts of the Ukraine here, like Odessa, the Crimea, have been part of Russia for 500 years, so there's a basis for settlement. You have three different objectives there, and they're mutually exclusive. And then I don't believe they have reached consensus on those. And, of course, that fuels the differences on sanctions.
William Jones, the three objectives that our guest Frank Emspach talks about, which ones do you think is the one that they're going to perhaps agree on, if you think that those are the three objectives that are out there for them to decide on?
Well, obviously, the ones who are controlling this thing are not the Ukrainians themselves. It is the British and the Americans. I emphasize the British, the statements coming out of Liz Truss and Boris Johnson, that we see here the British Empire being revived by the Biden administration. And on the ground, of course, in Ukraine, you have all these British SAS players on every level. And the Ukrainian president, I don't think, makes a statement unless he gets that statement from the controllers. He said a lot of contradictory things. And I think the contradiction is not simply in his own mind, but it's the different signals that he's getting from the people who are backing this thing. You're going to see more and more of this dissension. It's a situation which cannot be maintained short of going into a major war, which is always a real danger here when you're dealing with really a conflict between nuclear powers. That is, the U.S., which is the key player on the Western side, and Russia. But I think there's so much dissent, as the other speaker mentioned, France and Germany, who have been the major forces in the EU, have now been kind of overshadowed by a combination of the British, who have gotten a revived sense of so-called global Britain, and the East Europeans, who are just obsessed with this idea of Russia. The Poles, in particular, are playing a major role here, and I'm sure they want to enhance their position in Europe. by demanding stronger moves against Russia. But it's an existential situation that they're facing, that you have the obvious split in the EU right now over the oil, even more so over possible gas boycott. But as this begins to hit, as the prices continue to rise and the people in France and Germany and all of the European nations begin to see the cost of living shoot to the top, you're going to have people on the streets demanding a change here. So I think it's what we're seeing with the meeting today is only the tip of the iceberg in terms of the divisions that exist here, which I think will really end this whole thing. What the end result will be in Ukraine, I think Russia will not be moving from any territory anytime soon. And I think you're going to have a very lengthy political process being played out in which there is no clear solution for months and maybe for years. But hopefully the military action right. will stop. It will all go to the diplomatic negotiating table.
Frank Emsbeck, William Jones talks about the inconsistent statements coming from Zelensky. Just hours ago, Zelensky said Ukraine will fight until it gets all of its territory back. 3 days ago, he said, stop playing with Russia, end the war. Ukraine Zelensky to the West, Russia-Ukraine war, criticizing, I'm reading a headline, criticism of the West has mounted in recent days as the EU moves slowly towards a possible Russian oil embargo. This is 3 days ago. This is what the headline read. Inconsistencies in Zelensky's statements. Is he getting orders from the control room, and who is controlling that control room?
Well, I think the United States is the dominant arms supplier and the dominant cash supplier at the moment, and we have a very extreme position. I think Zelensky is caught in a variety of different ways. The rhetoric is one thing, but he had that the Azov battalion, which is now, of course, all captured, but their political force is still very much strong, very strong in Ukraine, and they've made it clear that they'll overthrow him before they agree to any kind of truce. So you've got internal political pressures on him and external ones, and so I think that he's going to go back and forth. My guess is that Henry Kissinger, of all people, laid out at Davos, and he got no publicity about this, at least in the United States, or very, very little. He said, here's the deal. The Russians will keep the Donbass and probably the land between Odessa and Crimea and the Crimea, and that's the settlement. And everybody understands that. So that was his position. And I thought that was very interesting that the European press picked that up actually quite a bit. You have in the French press a real clear, at this point, offensive against the expansion of NATO or against these militaristic things. So I don't know what's going to happen. And clearly, a position that says Russia will give up Crimea and eastern Donbass is simply a non-starter. That's not going to happen unless the Russian government is overthrown in some fashion. Maybe that's the United States' objective. But if so, then you're really risking a world war. And I know there isn't anybody other than people who are waving the flag here and to the extent in Ukraine who are actually partisans of that.
Do you think that's the objective of the U.S., William Jones, and are Europeans on board?
Well, they certainly are not on board, and I think there's a lot of dissension within the United States itself. Judging from a recent interview by Colonel Richard Black, who was now retired, a former state senator in Virginia, who went out publicly warning that this was like 1914 if we continue in that direction. He's gotten about, I think, 600,000 hits on his YouTube site and a lot of messages from military people, both in service and out of service, saying, congratulating him on taking this position. State Department, of course, wants to control the narrative. That's why they're trying to crack down on this. That's why the U.S. press didn't really cover the Kissinger statements, because the State Department wants to control this narrative of going to war because they know the opposition that exists here. And that's really, I think, the one reason to be optimistic in this is that you're seeing tremendous amounts of opposition to this insanity as we're approaching closer and closer to a conflict with Russia. And I think the fact that the economic sanctions and the moves against Russia are leading to massive inflation here in the United States, which may become incontrollable at a certain point, you're going to see the kind of mass upsurge in Europe and in the United States demanding an end to this insanity. But at the present moment, the administration here in the U.S., with the definite backing of their British friends, are pushing hard to make this into a major conflict. They hope, I'm sure, to try and, you know, push the Russians back. I don't think they're going to be successful, and I think they can. It creates a very dangerous situation, but I think it's going to start to fall apart because of the internal dynamics working here, which are against the populations of both Europe and the United States.
Well, to use William Jones' word there, Frank, MSPAC insanity, it seems like the U.S. did not step into that frame of mind, Joe Biden, that is, when it decided that it's not going to, I guess, allow for these rocket systems to be sent to Ukraine, which would reach Russian territory. Why do you think the U.S. decided on that?
Because I think people within the country and people within the Congress and people have some sense who say that nobody wants the kind of conflict that's going to develop. Look what happened when Biden said, look, our new defense perimeter is the middle of the Formosa Strait, you know, and we're going to defend Taiwan militarily. People all over the world suddenly said, oh, my God, you know, we can't, this is crazy. We're not going to do it. And he forced to at least verbally walk back. The problem that you've got here is that I think Biden mentally is sort of where Harry Truman was. He's basically a Cold War Democrat, and he feels that you have to be aggressive, stand strong, and keep the rhetoric up and so on and so forth, because they're afraid of being attacked by the right, by the Republicans. And I think that framework is not so prominent anymore. And what are you going to say, that the Democrats are communists? That's not going to work. So, you know, there's a mental framework here that's very dangerous. And it's a danger that is basically, if you have a $700 billion defense budget, just like, you know, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail, to, I think, increasingly the sort of mindset of American diplomacy and direction is that it's all a military. Look at what we're doing around the world. You can't separate our position on China from Ukraine and from this sort of bellicose position here. There's been no willingness on the part of the United States publicly, and I suspect privately, to even begin to say, what is it going to take here? What is the cause of this? You know, we may not understand it here, but, you know, to people in Europe, they say, gee, you know, NATO used to have 17 countries, and now it's got 30. Gee, you know, in 1990-91, Bush and the Secretary of State Baker said to Gorbachev and to Yeltsin and others, well, we're not going to expand NATO, and blammo, you have a hostile military force on your border. Well, what does that mean? And there's been no willingness on our part, it seems to me, to really recognize what an existential threat the Russians see in that. And everybody is on edge, and I believe, very dangerous situation.
William Jones, do you get the sense that there's been a little bit of a lull when it comes to military assistance to Ukraine? I mean, I'm going back a couple of weeks and maybe further than that, when you had almost every other day the U.S. making an announcement that it's going to assist Ukraine militarily. It was $5 billion or $20 billion, or I think the last one was $40 billion. And, of course, the EU countries always making announcements of military assistance. But now you're really not getting it. I mean, I'm looking, for example, at the piece of news about how Germany is being blasted, the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, coming under attack for not sending Ukraine enough weapons, for example. Of course, the most recent stance on military assistance came from France with its new foreign minister, Catherine Colonna, who said that Paris is ready to boost military aid. But Zelensky is asking for it. It's not really getting it, it appears. Do you think that there's a little bit of a pushback on providing military assistance to Ukraine?
Well, I think the assistance that has been given, the $40 billion that's been promised, I assume that's going to go out there. But I think there's resistance also within the Congress. Look, this thing is going to is having a massive effect on the U.S. inflation rate. We haven't seen the last of it, and on the price of oil and gas, as well as on the price of food. So when they see when the American people, and here we're going into election in November, which will decide the fate of the House and the Senate, and is going to really put the clamps if the Republicans make a lot of headway here on the Biden administration. And here they see American people see $40 billion going out to Ukraine, and they're asking themselves, hey, what about our bridges? You know, what about our roads? When is that going to happen? At that point, this becomes a reality in which Biden has to react politically. If he cannot come up with solutions that satisfy the needs of Americans, they're going to vote against them. They're going to give them a more difficult time after the congressional elections, and that will also probably play into the presidential elections. And I assume that Biden is also attentive of this situation, and maybe that causes a little bit of a back down on some of the weapons going in. I also think that there is a certain understanding somewhere in the mind of the president that at a certain point there's a red line, that if weapons go in there that that can really penetrate into Russia, can be used to attack Russia existentially, then you are in the danger of nuclear war. And I hope that's foremost in his mind rather than back of his mind. May have a play a role in the decision-making now.
Well, in the sense of when you talk about nuclear war, this economic chokehold that it has put countries not only within the EU, but also the U.S. itself, Frank Imspach, is devastating people. I mean, we're looking at, for example, German inflation to hit 8.7%. Now, they haven't seen that since the 1990. Looking at EU.
Thing about inflation, because it's still part of the historical memory, what happened after World War I. So thus, they're very upset about that. I would just differ a little bit on the inflation issues here. The day the war started, the gas prices go up. Well, we had plenty of gas, you know. So part of it is also a manufactured issue here, which can be dealt with. But I think worldwide it's a problem. And one of the things the Russians said the other day, which was in the European press, I did not see that in the American press, but I might have missed it, is that they said, how about a humanitarian thing and we'll ship grain? And we said, no. So, you know, there's those pressures as well. But I agree. Once you start putting offensive weapons in Ukraine, however they get there, you then basically set the stage for a escalation. And I think that you cannot have a situation that's stable when you've got a missile 5 minutes from your state, from your national capital, that can obliterate it. And I think that the Russians have been very clear about that for the last 10 years on in terms of NATO and the Ukraine in particular. And I think that's fundamental to their policy, just like we feel this way. We got upset, you know, when the Cuban had this missile crisis 50, 60 years ago. You know, and never mind having, let's say, Russian forces on the Canadian border. We would be hysterical. And I think that we need to have that thing and that understanding. And what's missing, really, in this political climate in the United States is what I would call a progressive and relatively widespread peace movement. That's gone. You have a conservative-led movement that's much more isolationist. And the 12 senators voted against aid, I think it was on Wednesday. So there is a bloc in the Senate who is not up for this, you know, but we'll see how that works. But politically, the inflation has got to be dealt with. It can't be dealt with on the backs of everybody here. Boris Johnson made the move yesterday to undercut, or 2 days ago now, to undercut the Labour Party by putting this excess profits tax on the oil companies. Well, that was quite a move. The conservatives fought that tooth and nail right up until they got the polling results on Thursday, which point they instituted it. So maybe we'll see some things like that happen here. I don't know.
Uh-huh. Well, we're quickly running out of time. When we take a look at this conflict or the war, William Jones, the repercussions are so wide. And it's not just about the EU, and it's not just about the U.S. We're talking about countries around the world that are suffering. And when you really take a look at the types of warnings that are coming from different types of organizations, whether it's the IMF or whether it's the Food and Agriculture Organization or a host of UN organizations that are saying, listen, there's going to be riots in countries that can't afford right now to feed their people. There are people in Africa that are not able to feed the malnourished there. And problems similar to this, which are erupting across the world. But when you look at who's leading the offensive here, it's the U.S. and, of course, NATO member countries. Do you think that there's going to reach a point where the brakes have to be put on forcefully on the U.S. and the EU, where countries are going to rise up and say, you guys got to stop with this war, let's reach a diplomatic solution?
I think it's already happening now. I mean, if you look at the situation, Russia is in a difficult situation, but they're working economically to get themselves out of that through other arrangements, not based on the dollar, not based on the dollar system, both with China and with many other countries. So you have actually the formation of alternative financial systems given this crisis. And of course, the crisis with the outflow of funds to the military and the pressure on the dollar, it's really the dollar is losing its role as an international currency. So there are certain fundamental systemic changes taking place as a result of this. And I think because it has gone so far, reaching the point of almost, you know, nuclear threshold, you have other people both in Europe and the United States, but also in Africa and Asia, Latin America, who are saying we've got to move in a different direction. And that different direction is not that the United States is the leader of the world and determines everybody's policy, but that the major countries of the world, including the big countries, including countries like China, India, Russia, have got to come together to discuss the solutions for mankind as a whole and not go into this kind of a Cold War mentality.
Thank you very much. We're fresh out of time. William Jones there, Washington Bureau Chief, the Executive Intelligence Review. Many thanks. Also, Frank Emspach, political analyst, who spoke to us from Madison. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye until next time.